This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Stax Records produced some of the most important Southern soul music of the 60s. Music by such performers as Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, Rufus and Carla Thomas, Booker T and the MGs, Isaac Hayes, and the Staple Singers. Here's some examples of the Stax sound. Stax Records was based in Memphis. It evolved out of the pop and country label Satellite, which was started in 1957 by Jim Stewart, who ran it with his sister, Estelle Axton. To mark that 50th anniversary, Concord Records, which acquired the Stax catalog, has been celebrating all year with reissues and concerts. Next week, PBS will air a documentary called Respect Yourself, the Stax Record Story. We thought we'd join the celebration by bringing you two of the people who helped create the Stax sound. First, Steve Cropper. Cropper was the house guitarist at Stax Records. The house band recorded their own records under the name Booker T and the MGs. Cropper also worked as a songwriter and producer for Stax. He produced some of Otis Redding's hits.
I've been loving you. My life has
so wonderful.
Steve Cropper spoke to Terry Gross in 1990. He told her he always thought of himself as a rhythm guitar player.
I never really was a lead player. I never tried to be a lead player. I've been lucky enough to have played a few solos on some great artist records. But really, I'm a rhythm man, and my best forte, I think, is capturing the feel of a song during its inception in the studio. I think that's where I'm best. Even though people fly me in all over to play on their records and overdub, I think they would be better using me on the ground floor, you know, as a building block rather than as a cherry on the cake.
You had your first hit with a band called The Marquise.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long after that you became affiliated with Stax Records. You became the guitarist in the house rhythm section. You became a producer. You became a songwriter with
floor with sweeper.
Stax. Yeah,
right. Tape copier and editor.
How did you get affiliated with Stax?
Well, it started Charles Axton, the tenor player, and the funny story about Charles Axton.
He was the tenor player with the Marquise?
He was a tenor player with the Marquise. He was on the record last night and everything. He came to me and he said, I hear you guys got a pretty good band. He said, you know, I play saxophone. I'd like to be in your band. And I said, well, I'm not really interested. I don't think we're interested in adding horns to the group. And I said, how long have you been playing, you know? And he said, oh, I've been taking lessons for 3 months. And I'm going, oh, yeah, great, you know. And somewhere in the conversation, he goes, oh, by the way, my mother owns a recording studio. And I said, can you show up for rehearsal on Saturday? And that is a true story. Now, I may stretch it a little bit, but that's an actual truth. And we went out. His uncle, Jim Stewart, the owner of Stax Records, had a little studio in his garage in Memphis, and we went out there and jammed around, and then they moved from his garage to a little place out in Brunswick, Tennessee, where they had the Satellite label. And we would go out there every weekend and play and all that. And, of course, Jim Stewart said that we never had a chance, we'd never make it. But I think he just was being devil's advocate to just see if he could push us into something. And we kept trying. We cut a bunch of instrumentals, some crazy little things that never saw the light of day. And until the time that we came up with last night. But what happened was Estelle Axton, I don't know if she saw any talent there or what she saw, but she liked me enough to keep me around, and she put me to work in her record shop. And I sold records. That's what I did. And I kept working on the weekends. I would kind of do a little A&Ring because people were always coming in. And on Saturdays, I would hold auditions because people were always bringing in songs and all that. And that's sort of how I got started, you know, in the A&R thing. And finally, Jim said, wait a minute. He said, you know, Steve's spending more time in the studio and he is in a record shop and whatever. And so they got together and decided that I would be start getting my salary from the record company rather than the record shop. And I started working, I guess, A&R full time at that point.
Well, you, with the group Booker T and the MGs, had the hit of Green Onions. And I think mm-hmm. this was a... It's a big hit, and it helped out Stax Records a lot. How did the four of you, Booker T, Al Jackson, Donald Duck Dunn, and yourself get to play together and become the house rhythm section?
Well, what it all stemmed from basically was there we were with all this great success doing the Dick Clark Show and everything as the Marquise, and we had this big hit record last night, and it was a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden it wasn't fun anymore. It became work and what you call a road burdened and that sort of thing, and seven of us or eight of us traveling in one car and trying to make all these shows. And I found out that I wasn't too happy with the road. And so what I really wanted to do was get back in the studio. I mean, I already knew that that's what I wanted to do. Anyway, that's what I did. I came back to Memphis. I went to work in the studio again. I helped put together the rhythm section. I found out I'd been playing with another band called the Club Handy Band, and we had done some sessions for Don Robey. I think, I don't even remember which songs, but I played on the Five Blind Boys albums. I played on Al T&T Braggs. I think there was some Bobby Blue Bland stuff that I played on. But I played with a lot of those musicians, and we were asking around to find out who was a real good keyboard player. We had used several, and they said, there's this kid, he's still in school, named Booker T. Jones, and he's incredible. And they had worked with him on a lot of other stuff and on stage as well. And so we got Booker over on a session, And everybody just fell in love with him.
Let me play some of Green Onions, and because we're only going to play an excerpt, I'm going to start this a little in because I want to get to your guitar solo in it. So this is Green Onions, Booker T, and the MGs. Guitarist Steve Cropper is my guest. I want to ask you about some of the now classic records that you played on. Some of these are songs that you co-wrote. You co-wrote Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, and you produced the record as well, right?
Right, correct.
What was your collaboration with him like when it came to writing songs?
Well, of course, we wrote a lot of songs together. The inception of Dock at the Bay was really no different than any other one. Otis was one of those kind of guys who had 100 ideas, and he always had with him, anytime he came in to record, 10 or 15 different pretty good ideas, either intros or titles or whatever. And he had been in San Francisco doing the Fillmore. And the story that I got, he had rented a boathouse or stayed out at a boathouse or something. That's when he got the idea of watching the ships come in the bay there. And that's about all he had. I watched the ships come in, watch them roll away again, and I'm sitting on the dock of the bay. And I just took that. We just sat down, and I just kind of learned the changes that he was kind of running over, and I finished the lyrics. And if you listen to songs that I collaborated with Otis, most of the lyrics are about him. Well, he never really, he might say the big O in a song or something like that, but Otis didn't really write about himself, but I did. Songs like Mr. Pitiful, Sad Song, Fa Fa, they were all about Otis and Otis's life, and Dock of the Bay is exactly that. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. It was all about him going out to San Francisco to perform. And that's kind of the way I wrote with Otis. I wrote the bridge and stuff like that. And that's the way we collaborated. He trusted me. I always seemed to do the things that he liked, worked on songs that came out the way he wanted them. And I also worked on a lot of songs with Otis, arrangement-wise, and helped him put them together and all that, where I didn't, claim any writers or anything, because it wasn't necessary. Otis had most of it finished to begin with, and I just helped him do it. But a lot of these things where he had just bits and pieces, I would actually put them together, and we'd make whole songs out of them and go in the next day and record them. So we had a lot of fun together. Otis was a great guy to work with, and he was a great friend.
Well, let's listen to the record. This is Dock of the Bay.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Listen, sitting here resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. Listen, 2,000 miles I roam,
just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on a dock of the bay, wasting time.
I want to ask you about another record. And this is also a song you co-wrote. You co-wrote this one with Wilson Pickett, and it's Midnight Hour.
Uh-huh.
This was, I think, for the first session that you played with Wilson Pickett.
Right, it was.
Tell me about writing the song with him.
Well, it's real simple. We knew that he was coming down, and, of course, my connection with the record shop. And I went up and found some stuff that he had sung on. Of course, he sang, you know, with the Falcons, and he had sang some spiritual things. And it seemed like every time that he sang lead on something, when he got down to the fade-out, he would go, oh, wait till the midnight hour. Whoa, see my Jesus in the midnight hour. And all this, I said, that's the guy's ID. So I just took that right there and presented it to him with a little idea. He had a couple ideas. And what happened was that we picked him up at the airport. They dropped us off at the hotel. And Jerry Wexler and Jim Stewart went out to get something to eat and just talk business. And when they came back, I don't know, it was a couple hours later, we had In the Midnight Hour written and Don't Fight It. They said, we're going to get out of here, let you guys keep going. And they left, and we wrote a thing called I'm Not Tired. And we went in the studio the next day, recorded all three songs, and all three songs were hits. Very lucky me, huh?
Well, let's hear In the Midnight Hour. Wilson Pickett in the Midnight Hour, co-written by my guest Steve Cropper, who's featured on guitar. You also did a lot of work playing behind Sam and Dave. And Sam and Dave were the inspiration for the Aykroyd and Belushi group, the Blues Brothers, and you played with them as well. What did you think of the Blues Brothers when they got started, or when you got started, or whatever? what did you think of... did you think that it was... A parody that was in bad taste at all? You know, like two white guys doing their parody of black singers, two white guys who probably fantasize about themselves sometimes of being being black singers. But what was your take on it?
Well, you know, they got a lot of bad rap on that, I think, initially. And a lot of people, for some reason, thought that John and Danny were kind of scoffing black musicians for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case at all. And what I found out was really the contrary to all of that. They had such a love for that kind of music, for rhythm and blues and so forth. And I couldn't believe, I went to John's house one day, and he showed me a collection of blues stuff that just blew me away. I'd never seen that big of a collection of blues music. Of course, being in Chicago, he had a lot of access to a lot of stuff that, of course, we never heard in Memphis and so forth. It never really, most of it didn't reach the record shop that I worked in. But... you mentioned about Sam and Dave being their influence. That is something that really came about whenever they decided to put a band together and got Duck Dunn and myself involved in the group. Because they were from the show, you know, from the routine they did on the show, their concept of an album at that point was strictly doing nothing but blues kind of songs. And, you know, things by the Down Child Blues Band and you know, Delbert McClinton stuff and all those kind of things. And I felt... you know, I'd been in the business a long time, and I felt if they wanted me to contribute anything to this, I thought they should go a little bit more commercial. And so it was my suggestion, along with Duck Dunn and all, that we do something like Soul Man. And we later did Who's Making Love as well. But we talked them into doing that, and then they started asking about, well, how did Sam and Dave do, you know? And so we kind of started showing them some of the routines, like some of the dance things that Sam and Dave would do on stage. And they go, yeah, man, this can be fun. So that's something that was sort of a new ingredient put in the Blues Brothers act as we started making preparation to do a show.